architect that come forward and have ugly drawings and look like it's going to be a lousy place. Quite often, you know, they're people with balloons. You know, it looks very nice. The images, we've all seen pretty pictures to the point where we don't trust them anymore. What you need to do, and here's an example of taking that plan and wrapping a code around it, you turn that master plan into a regulating plan. This is the town center, the easternmost part of Columbia Pike. That illustrative plan becomes a master plan, a technical plan, pardon me, and we call it the regulating plan. Here's the illustration. Notice first the early conception of this community green. Here's what it looks like in the code. Different hatching here because at that time it was not an existing public space, but that's to be the public space. And these colors, we'll talk more about them, but they have implications. If you own a piece of property where you front the red, there's a set of rules telling you what your building can do. Blue, et cetera. And by the way, the yellow is what's essentially a protective coating to keep these single-family houses from having the pressure of change on them. It's a coating for any new thing that gets built there will also be a single-family house. Form-based codes can promote development as well as they can protect existing development. They just do it from the standpoint of, first, the form of the structure. Getting ahead of my sequence. Within a year of the code being written, these properties were in play. The three on top were out at the western end of the county. And I think this shows what you really want a code to do. You change the rules and you affect not just one project, but you affect a bunch of individual projects, different owners, different developers, different architects. But they're all working in concert because they're all working towards the same master plan. Here's one of them, and you're going to see these a couple of times. I'll go through them quickly. Approved by the board. This one's being built right now. Columbia Station. This was the charrette drawing of what was envisioned to be that public space on, this is Columbia Pike on the bottom, called Penrose Square for the Penrose neighborhood behind it. The Penrose neighborhood was very involved in the process, and you're going to see what the reality of that. This is where that square is going to be. It's a shopping center they call Adams Square, which is misuse of the language. Here's an earlier drawing of what's being built there now. I'll let my things get ahead of me. So we're going from a parking structure to a public square. This worked for a number of reasons. I think the county, and Richard could talk more about this, may have had to come in with some financial trade-offs there. But the increased value of being able to build this large building in the upper right, which has about a 50,000 square foot grocery store in the middle of a very well enough to do neighborhood, that's a great market for them. And they're about five stories of residential units up there. So they were able to get a lot of value by building to this plan, even though they took away some private property. And a project that talks about really what the promise of a form-based code. This is a site that's been torn down now. It's under construction. These drawings were made during the charrette, or during and right after the charrette. The idea of a code is someone builds a building. If someone builds next door to them on a different lot, they're complementary. They're all part of the different pieces of the same puzzle. They work together. You do a project that will accept transit, whether it's bus or rail. And here's a question to think about architectural code. And at what level of the public's interest is it to regulate in terms of style? And this is a slightly different take than Rogers, and although I think we're actually not very far apart on that, for the sake of this presentation and you all, I'll stick on the side of that building style or building aesthetic matters less. But is that something you want to regulate, or do you want to allow both of those or either of those things to happen? obviously you don't want to let something like that sit in the middle of your city because it's a real negative. Here's the project that's being built there, board approved. Here's a project that was approved. The citizens, it's outside of the district, the citizens took the developer and asked him to use the form-based code. The developer, this is after they told him his first proposal was a no. By the way, the citizens are very happy with this because it saved more of the hillside. Here, the neighbors right behind. The developer was happy with it because he got an extra unit. And they went before the board and supported the project, which in Arlington County is used to be very unusual. How are we doing for time? I want to cram one more thing in, okay. if Richard will let me. This is a walkthrough. We're gonna walk through from the point of view of your property owner. Describe the form-based code. If you want to know what the guy across the street is going to do with his property, or if you own a piece of property that's within the Columbia Pike plan, well, there are three easy pieces. The first one is the regulating plan. Here's that town center regulating plan. Up in the right-hand corner, there's a key that connects those colors of street frontage to rules for the building, rules for the building. Here's one, actually from a different code, but pay no attention to that. Let's imagine you've got this property on the corner of Pike Street and B Street. Now, the regulating plan has lines and colors on it, tells you a number of things. The first one, let's look at this line. This is a required build-to line. Some minimum percentage of the building, let's call it 80%, of the building has to start there. So you know the building, most of it's going to sit on that corner. If you stand on the sidewalk, you can put your hand and there'll be a building there, or 80% of the time. Second line, and that's not a setback, you really start the building there. Second line, this is a parking setback line. You don't know how the property owner is going to handle their on-site parking. You don't know if it's going to be underground, if it's going to be above ground wrapped by the building. You don't know if it's going to be a parking structure or surface parking. That's up to the builder, developer. They've got to park their building, but they have to figure out how. What you do know is the parking, except for on-street parking, the parking is going to be behind that line, which in this case is set back 30 feet. You won't be, because this is a downtown area, this isn't out in the boonies, you won't have to walk by a big parking lot or a small one. A third line is a boundary line, and it's just recognizing all parts of a building aren't fronts. You can imagine a building on a city street may have a back to an alley or even a parking lot. The way the code is written, it's very specific, this required building line is that's the civic face of the building, the facade. That has to be a living thing and make the street and the sidewalk work. There are rules about window openings, having functioning entry doors, materials, etc. Well, it doesn't make sense to have that against an alley. In this case, it's a light rail line. It's several blocks away from the station, so it's sort of like an alley or it's a rear. Well, you don't require the person to, as it were, gold plate the back of the building. That's just a line saying you can't spill beyond that, kind of a boundary line. The red dashed line, that one has demands. That's where you have to be part of the community. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, is that color in the frontage. That tells you what to do with the building that fronts it. Now, the reason is, it's done on the street instead of the lot. There are a couple, but if you're a person on a bicycle or a car or on foot walking down B Street, this means the buildings on both sides are really making part of the same space, just like in this room. The walls make this room, so they have roughly the same rules. You don't change uses in the middle of a street. You don't change forms in the middle of a street. so it's consistent. And that yellow coating sends you to the building envelope standards to find what's going to happen to that building in the third dimension. Here you see, actually it's this one, those codes. This is a building envelope standard. For this code, a general site, 90% of what's going to happen to that building, the rules for that building, are on this one 11 by 17 page. And it's subdivided into basic rules for height, siding, where the building has to sit, where it may sit, elements, windows and doors. If it were a house, it could be a front porch. And finally, the parameters for use. So the first part, the regulating plan, tells us, you know where that building's going to sit. You know, a minimum height, maximum height. Elements, you know it's going to have windows and doors. It won't be a blank wall. You'll know those percentages. And you'll know basically the parameters. In this case, the ground floor on that site could be office or residential. Up above the ground floor, retail, office, or residential. This is a pretty flexible one. The ground floor above could be anything but retail. So there's a lot of flexibility. If you live across the street from this, you know the form of the building, and you know it's going to have some different uses in it. The ground floor is likely to be retail. It's a little bit, at this point, like you're looking at a department store mannequin, kind of a blank form. Well, that's what brings us to the third point, the architectural standards. Speaking as the guy with the bow tie, I sometimes call the architectural standards the dress code. Now, some aspects of it are just about style or materials, but other aspects, you know, if you tell somebody that the ground floor has to have clear glass instead of mirrored glass, that's not about style or look, that's really about function. If you've got mirrored glass on a building, there's zero communication between inside and outside. The guy who owns that store, if he wants to wear mirrored sunglasses, that's his business, but the storefront windows have to be clear to allow that those eyes to go back and forth. A quick point about these codes, what you'll see in these are rules that are very clear. There's a kind of line in the sand. You know if you're on the right side of it or the wrong side of it. It is, I think, if you're dealing with guidelines, maybe, but when you're talking about codes, you don't say things like streets should be of human scale. I don't know what that, I have my idea and I know it's right, but yours is probably a little different. You don't say things, uses should be compatible, because you know there's going to be an argument there. You say very simple things. If you think, here's an example. Pardon me. Roger did this too, so it's okay. Openings for windows, window panes, and doors, the height shall exceed the width. That's, if somebody's reviewing that, they can tell pretty quickly. You know, it's easy to judge. There's not much debate. If a designer or developer is trying to meet a code to meet that standard, they know what it is. They can do it. Quick point, when you're talking about retail, the windows and doors, because that's where the private building really interacts and there's synergy with the public space, with the street and the sidewalk, it's the most complicated of all to regulate. It's got the most detail. And at a basic level, as I said before, it's very different for residential than it is for retail. And, of course, it's different for public buildings as well. Here's an example. This is some kind of a cooking store. Now, it's a great retail street. There's something, I think, inherent to human beings. You walk down a street like this, and it's interesting. I can't cook for beans, and I'd like it better if this were a hardware store with stuff in the windows. But when I walk by a shop like this, I find it interesting, strangely interesting, just because that kind of environment's human beings seek. When I walk down the street, I'm looking inside, and inside is looking outside. you have a different set of regulations appropriate to a retail storefront or retail street front than you do a residential. That needs to be part of your code. Yep. And that one shouldn't be in there. So to recap, there are three easy pieces, the basic structure of a form-based code. There's the regulating plan that you can look at. It's site-specific. It goes block by block and lays down where the streets are, where that buildable lot is, and what's going to happen in the street. The building envelope standards, which are the rules for the private developer that talks about how tall the building must be, minimums, maximums, how much of the building must be up to the street, and aims to mainly regulate the facade. It deals a little bit with things in back because these different buildings have to get along and function in the larger city, but it's mainly about the building facade forming the public realm, which is the space all of us have a stake in. And third, the architectural standards to get an idea of that building. Will it be made out of materials that are local? Will it look like it came from outer space, et cetera, et cetera? And I hope we get a chance. I hope I get a chance to talk more about lessons learned because I'm really lousy about this with Columbia Pike. It's something we did a few years back, and we've made so many changes in the way we do things that I think, on the one hand, are relatively minor but can have major implications, and I can't bring them to mind because we've done on other codes. I think that's, I go back to Columbia Pike, and on some specific wording, I think that's the way we had it written back then. But actually, we've changed a couple of words, largely based on that experience. There's a lot of positive lessons. Form-based codes work. Nothing had happened on Columbia Pike, with the exception of two drive-in businesses that were well disliked for 40 years. We changed the system in the way that some things were approached, and it's like unleashing a logjam. The public process is golden. I think Richard and I will talk about this more, but the things that were done through that public process happened in a way that I think is more democratic and certainly faster and went and reached deeper than the normal Arlington process, which is, although it has a heavy level of citizen involvement, is much slower and really limited, which could get me in trouble if anyone's here from Arlington County other than Richard. Coding by frontage, we can talk about why that's a good idea later. A lot of things hit the nail on the head, but there are a bunch of things that we do differently now. Obvious, I would say, and you've heard before, staff involvement at all levels is necessary. Staff involvement from all departments is necessary. A lot of the things that have happened in Columbia Pike, on the way to building, they had this super slick planning approval. But then from some of the other aspects of development, you had to get an okay from Public Works, et cetera. They weren't used to that kind of speed, and they weren't equipped to handle it yet. And something that's more for a code writer, be aware of the precedents in conventional zoning of language, interpretation, policy. People are so used to doing things under this certain way of thinking. And where the form-based code is simple but a different system, you can get into some interesting, like the Tower of Babel, some interesting miscommunications here, and it makes that language and that work up front that much more important. And with that, I'll get Richard down here and tell you before he gets here that when I met him in 2002, he didn't have gray hair. And I had less.
Thanks, Jeff. While we're getting set up here, I'll just give you a little background, a little history about me. As opposed to Roger, who is a professor, or Lee, who's the son of a professor, or Jeff, who looks like a professor, I'm just a planner. But if you're going to be a planner, you should be a senior planner, which I am, which means I get to go to the public meetings all by myself without a supervisor looking over my shoulder. These guys have told you about how great form-based code is as an alternative, as a tool. As someone who has implemented the tool, I'm here to tell you that they're right. Give you a little history about Arlington County, or talk about myself a little bit more. I worked for the past over 15 years in redevelopment, revitalization in various locales, Texas, Ohio, Kentucky. I've been in Virginia for about 9 years now, working for first Fairfax County and now Arlington. So I think I have a good background about in the area of redevelopment, revitalization, housing planning, how to do it right. I've worked on comprehensive plans, sector plans, and in most occasions, in most places where I work, those things just go up on the shelf. They don't get implemented well. What we really do well in Arlington is couple our sector plans, our master plans, with implementation strategies, and we've been very effective with that. Looking at Arlington County, I think we are well known around the country and in the region for our transit-oriented development around our metro station areas. I used to work, I think as mentioned in your handouts, I worked on Columbia Pike for 5 years, and more recently I'm working on the East Falls Church study area. We're not going to do a sector plan, we're going to do an area plan for that area, but that's the one metro stop in Arlington that doesn't have a sector plan or an area plan. But Arlington had made a conscious decision when Metro was being planned to concentrate development around the Metro stations and keep the areas away from Metro relatively low in scale and density. As part of that, the Columbia Pike Corridor kind of got left out of the mix, the planning mix, for many, many years. Back in the 80s, there was a desire to revitalize Columbia Pike because the shopping centers that are typical to most of these corridors were in a state of decay and disuse. And there are articles in the Washington Post from the 80s that say, you know, revitalization is coming to Columbia Pike. That was in the 80s. If you go out to the day, you still don't see revitalization. We're getting there. Let me back up a little bit. Because of this planning process that took place in the 60s and 70s around Metro and development, our citizens are very well-versed in planning, doctrine, practices, and so forth. They're very well-educated. They are very involved. Our civic associations are very powerful in Arlington. And I understand, and just part of our preparation, that the audience in front of me here is similarly situated. Smart people, involved people. But I got to tell you, Arlingtonians are smarter. And that's a bit of a double-edged sword, and I'll get to that later. Columbia Pike. Back in the 80s, this area, the town center area, was designated as the revitalization district. For 20 years, nothing really happened. We had some streetscape that's now old that was implemented at the time. And what we did in 2002 was expand the district to include these non-contiguous areas and apply the form-based code. As part of the Columbia Pike Initiative, which started in 1998, ended in 2002 with the Columbia Pike Initiative Plan, we came up with 25 specific recommendations for redevelopment of Columbia Pike that included not only the land use and zoning, but transportation and affordable housing and public facility, all those things wrapped into one big document. The form-based code, which we really didn't know about in 2002, is just a part of it. We actually, at the time, were thinking about an urban design handbook, sort of guidelines. But one of our elected officials went to a conference and heard from our consulting team, Jeff Farrell and from Farrell Madden and Dover Cole, heard about form-based code, and that's what we ended up implementing. Our form-based code, just from a technical standpoint, let you know, is an optional zoning category. We actually had a vacant district or section in our zoning ordinance, and we wrote the regulations for form-based code, and we stuck it in the zoning ordinances. And all the other zoning categories that are found within the Columbia Pike Revitalization District have language in them referring back to this section. So Section 20 is form-based code, and all the other sections refer back to Section 20 as an optional zoning regulation. It is prescriptive. There's no density limits, just height limits. Once a developer decides that they want to use form-based code, they use those rules. So we're not forcing anyone over a barrel. We're not taking away their buy right options or their options through the special exception process. We're giving them another way of doing it. Once they make that decision themselves, then they must follow the rules. We have an expedited approval process, which is part of the reason why we've been able to spur development. Jeff reviewed some of the projects that have been approved, and I'll go over them in more detail. But again, nothing had happened on Columbia Pike for a long, long time. So just by virtue of the fact of adopting the code and having this public process with the charrette and so forth, we have created interest, and part of that has been the expedited approvals. Usually, we extract a lot of money from developers through our public process, and our citizens have gotten very skilled at getting what they want. And there are competing interests between the affordable housing and the public art, and all those factions get in the game. We eliminated that for Columbia Pike for one primary reason. Since nothing had been built on Columbia Pike, there is no established market. So what a developer could afford to pay in additional extractions is zero, really, at this point, until a market is proven. And part of our agreement with the community was, we'll come back to the question of extractions and, you know, with, you know, affordable housing, et cetera, when that market is proven, when we have stuff built and when we can establish how much profit the developer is making and how upset we're going to be about that. And then, you know, we'll come in with our money bags open. We have limited modifications. In going through the charrette process and having everyone affirm what the vision is, and then coding to that vision, we have to ensure that the developer does exactly what the community wanted them to do. And so there are limited modifications. Some of the things that the citizens have allowed the board to approve modifications for, deal with historic preservation. There are a few older properties, real issues with topography and so forth, the exact location of streets and alleys, trees and streetscape details. Sometimes those things don't really work out, and signage. But other than that, if the code says that the maximum height on the site is six stories, the maximum height is six stories. And you cannot believe how good it is for us as staff to sitting in a meeting room with developers who say, can't we get seven stories? Can't we just, no. It feels so good just to say no. Because usually it's a negotiation. We say, well, we don't know. I mean, take it to the community, see what they say, when we don't know. But in this case, you know, the rules are the rules, and we can stick to them. You know, and this is because the charrette was done. We got the input from our citizens, and we coded to that vision. And we've gotten to the point where folks are really, you know, they believed everything that Jeff told them. They believed everything that the folks from Dover Cold told them. I mean, they just absorbed it, and they spit it back at us. And so there was a question earlier about, you know, what happens when sometime down the line, you know, someone new comes to the game and they're thinking something different. Well, you know, a new citizen moves in. You know, you might say that they're the uncoopted or the newcomers, or, you know, what we call them, yahoos. And they think, oh, it doesn't have to be that way. And our citizens actually, we don't say anything. The citizens talk to their neighbors, to the other person across the room, and says, no. What we agreed in the charrette was, so it really makes it easy for staff to go ahead and do, you know, just follow the code, just implement it, because everyone has bought in. Because everyone's bought in and the standards have been set and the vision is there, we set up our review process where we have informal discussions, meetings with the developer, just to figure out, you know, how do they get their project to conform to the code? how do they actually put the building on the site? What are the specifics? What are the particulars? And we give them feedback back and forth to get them to the point where their application is acceptable. But once we accept that application, we're certifying that the application is complete and it conforms to the form-based code and therefore should be approved. There's no citizen input into that. So once we accept it, if it's a small site, we sort of did this in stages. For smaller sites, staff will make that assessment. We will invite in representatives from the affected civic associations. There are 11, or actually 10 civic associations on Columbia Pike that have a say in all this. We'll invite in the affected civic association reps, and we'll sit down as staff, and we'll confirm in front of them that the application is complete for the smaller sites. For larger sites, we will have a community meeting where we do the same thing. The applicant gets up and says, this is my project, and then staff, myself, will get up and say, well, here's how it conforms. There are no areas where it doesn't conform, and people ask questions. The first project that went through, we had that meeting. The applicant did their thing, and I did my thing, and the only question, and it was about this many people in the room, the only question that came up was, how much is the condo selling for? We didn't talk about brick color. We didn't talk about height. We didn't talk about anything. People just wanted to, hey, when are you going to get started? So that was, you know, again, that was the great thing. We have one planning commission meeting for these larger sites where, again, we just confirm what we know about the project being in conformance. And then we go to the county board meeting and it's officially approved. When we adopted the form-based code, and when the first project came through, there was, you know, a crowd about this size, applause. Great. This is great. This is wonderful. We like this process. We like the project. This is great. We want more. That is in stark contrast to our usual special exception process, where no matter who you are, you're on the left side of this graphic. I stole this from Jeff years ago, so now it's mine. If you're a citizen, then you're on the left side and the big bad developer's on the right. And if you're a developer, you're on the left and the citizens are on the right. That's our usual process. It's a battle of attrition. Talk about, you know, what the form-based code has done for us. You know, Charette was a big success. We had in a county where we typically have a lot of involvement. People really do come out. They set their personal calendars around the meetings we have for our planning processes. So there's no shortage of people coming out. But we had a lot of people come out to the show. We had over 700 people come out to the four major public meetings that we had during that week. Developers got interested. During the charrette, Jeff and the other consultants met with some of the landowners to explain to them what their options were. They also talked with outside developers who were interested in the Pike suddenly. So all that stuff came together as a result. Another benefit is architects really get the code. Instead of really having to guess what the public might want, and comparing that to what the developer needs, it's all set. It's all there for them. They really get it. Now, we've gotten so many compliments from architects who say, man, we get this. We understand this. It's easy to design around this. And the best thing is that staff and citizens really agree on what the vision is. They've seen it. The consultants gave them great graphics that kind of explain things. So they know, you know, from get-go, what can happen on a particular site. And not just the nice leafy green picture that somebody drew, but what can actually happen on a specific site. They know it, and we know it, and so there's not any miscommunication about that. The bad thing is developers always seek to maximize. So you better be sure that what you've written is what you want, because that's what you're going to get. They're going to squeeze out every square foot they can get. And if you've written it in a funny, squiggly kind of way and you haven't run it by the attorneys, they're going to find that extra story that you didn't think you were giving. They're going to find that basement level that, you know, you didn't know was there. They're going to find it. So be careful about that. There are construction constraints. And we didn't know this going in, but, you know, you just find this out. We listened to the community, and basically the maximum height generally on Columbia Pike is going to be six stories. They didn't want Ballston. They didn't want Roslyn, downtown D.C. They wanted Columbia Pike to be distinct, and the maximum height for most sites is six stories. Well, that actually happens to be in a construction no man's land where it's too expensive to build with steel construction or concrete, and it can't be built stick. So you have to really think about when the vision is out there and people are talking about maximum height, you really got to figure out it's either going to be greater than eight stories or less than four or four or less, or it's not going to get built. So the projects that we have, you know, coming through the pipeline now, squeeze through, herk jerk, you know, these guys figured out a way. But it's been a fight. It's been a battle. I know more about building construction now than I did 2 years ago as a result. It's just a mad array of rules that have to be met. And, you know, figure this out beforehand before you decide what your vision is. The worst thing about the form-based code, and again, I say this again, our citizens took it hook, line, and sinker. They bought it. They own it. They live it. They agree with it. They want it. And now it cannot be changed. Not if we suggest it. We in working with developers, we found problems, issues that need to be worked out. We can't amend the code to save our lives. However, there are certain things that were written into the code that citizens didn't quite agree with or didn't quite understand. That was on page 20, and they didn't get that far. And now that they see this there, God, it's got to get out of there. We can't have that. So when our citizens, who are all powerful, don't agree, we can amend the code. But when they do agree, it's going to stay the same. And that's been a real challenge for us. Here's the ugly. Jeff was in a public place picking his nose. No. Jeff alluded to this. His pencil was outside of his nose. It just he was thinking, he was planning. We were under pressure from our political leadership, our county board. We have five members that are elected at large, and the one county board member who actually lives there and they're elected at large. He actually lives off of Columbia Pike, and this was his baby. And it was his turn to be the chairman. They rotate the chairmanship, and he was the chairman. He said, "This thing has to be approved by the end of the year." We had planned to do the charrette in July, and we hadn't gotten these guys under contract at that point. So we had to push it back to September. So we had from September to December to do all the work. We didn't actually get it all done. We actually approved the code in February of next year, 2003. But we basically had 6 months, which was not enough time to do all the staff work, all the checking and so forth that we needed to do. One of the things we didn't do was actually survey properties affected or within the district. So we had no idea where, you know, utilities were, where the property lines were. In some cases, the property lines, properties extended into what we knew as the street. So we didn't have an opportunity to reconcile the regulating plan to the actual on-the-ground conditions. And there, you know, if we had the time, we could have made some site-specific adjustments to the code that really acknowledged the topography or where the utilities actually were and so forth. So we just, you know, we were just out of luck. So we got the thing approved, and again, people applauded and everyone's happy. And when's the first project happening? But there was a lot of work that didn't get done, and we had to do that as each applicant came in for these first few projects that we got approved. We were just getting blown out of the water by issues that we had no idea existed. Also, we didn't have a whole lot of time to work with the county attorney on the specific language. As Jeff mentioned, you know, once you write it down and you adopt it, it has implications. And we didn't get a chance to work through all those things. And I remember when we adopted the form-based code, because the political pressure was get it done. So the board was ready to approve anything that came before them. And they did. But working with the county attorney, we have a draft of that form-based code where there were, you know, language in the margins like, this is not specific enough. This is wrong. This can't be enforced. But but there it is. Very expensive undertaking. Jeff has bought his first and second home based on the contracts that he has had with us. The first contract was with Dover Cole and with Jeff to do the charrette and the writing of the code. Since then, we spent about $250,000 actually doing the survey of Columbia Pike, so we actually would understand where the utilities lie and so forth. We've had $100,000 in other traffic and transportation studies along the way. When we adopted the code, one of the things, we kind of adopted it piecemeal because there was a disagreement with our citizens. It was, I should have included this slide. The consultants actually came up with a graphic to show, you know, once everything's built, this is what it would look like. And included in that, we had been always talking about transit on Columbia Pike. Currently, Columbia Pike has the bus service on Columbia Pike has the most usage daily of any bus line in the state of Virginia, over 12,000 boardings a day. And so in the future, we plan to have streetcars as an improvement on current service, which is actually timed up with Metro. Columbia Pike bus service terminates either at Pentagon Station or Pentagon City Station, and the buses are timed to arrive there just before the trains do. So you can get on the bus in the morning and then arrive at your destination just before the train gets there. So these guys, in acknowledgement of that, plan the street width to include streetcars in exclusive lanes. Our citizens said, no, we don't want that. That street width was 128 feet wide, and we went through an eight-month process to redefine street space, and in the end, we narrowed it way down to 121 feet, 8 inches. But that's what they wanted. Transitions, who pays when, it's all, you know, we it's a jumble. We've got four projects, major projects that have been approved. The last one by site plan because it was just too hard to do under form-based code. Too many rules, too many problems. First project, historic building is right there, a little two-story building. Here's what was approved. What we didn't know, there was an existing substation. 11th Street was actually not on the property owner's property. So where we wanted 11th Street to come through, they couldn't build it. But we had to work around that. The easiest project was the Columbia Pike Safeway. Jeff showed this illustration. This is under construction right now. The biggest issue was how to differentiate these different elevations. We have what's called a 60-foot rule. Instead of having one building looking like one big long block, it has to look like several different buildings. This project can't get built. This guy was actually ready to build this the day that the code was adopted. He wanted to build this. He ran out of money. He sold it to some other guys who looked at the code again and said, hey, we could build this. And citizens woke up and said, I didn't know the code allowed something like that. So we've been fighting about that one since. One of the issues is when you have two building envelope standards, Main Street, which is red, and Local, which is blue, and you got a corner, which rules apply at the corner? I don't know the answer yet. Also, here's a street that was proposed. Our citizens said, well, that's not really going to be big enough. We want a street, they want this street. This is the street we were going to do, which actually took away a lot of his site area. You can see his townhouses are going to get cut off right there. So just a major, you know, and we're fighting through that. The Petro site, an old building, trashy. Used to be a barn there called Bad Habits. What else do you need to know? This is the project that was approved. What we didn't know, that there's a 96-inch storm sewer running through that parking lot. So in order to, we worked 6 months with these guys to figure out, you know, how are we gonna solve that. This is what they're actually going to do. They're going to move the pipes into the street. But it took a long time to get there. Also, they're going to build a proposed road to get to the alley in the back because, of course, parking needs to be in the rear. On the form-based code, on the regulating plan, the street is actually shown over here. From a regulatory standpoint, this is a VDOT road. VDOT says put the road right there. Adams Square, last one. Here's the vision. Here's the illustrative plan. Here's a nice illustration. This is what people say, yeah, go build that. Here's what's actually going to get built. Looking at the regulating plan, you've got, here's the problem. Cleveland Street is not on their property. Only half of the green space is on their property. This is a street that's supposed to be built vehicular to this point and then pedestrian only here. This is the only street that was easy, just that there. And then there's this alley that's supposed to cut through the site in this direction. Looking at the what they actually are going to build, here's Cleveland Street. It's just future Cleveland Street. They're just going to plant some trees on the periphery of the site. They can only plant half of the open space. The alley could not be built. They're going to build over a drive-through, an accessway to the garage underneath. The giant that was on the site in the back, this is the floor plate of the giant, 63,000 square feet. The code was written to allow only 50,000 square feet as a maximum because we thought everybody could build like Harris Teeter. That's not the case. Here's a view of the site through the park. The loading has to happen on Adams Street. As a result, the giant is on the second floor, not the first, in order to get the elevation right for the loading in this location. So there's ground floor retail here that's only 12 feet from the floor to the structure above. So after they drop the lights and everything, it's probably going to be 11 feet tall or 10. Staff alluded to this, coordination. Any engineers among you? Okay, I'm going to offend you now. Lee mentioned before that, you know, it's not that engineers are stupid. Okay. But there are rules that they follow that nobody else has to follow. Everyone else has to be creative. Planners have to be creative. Engineers stick to the rules. And there's an inherent conflict there. Building and fire code really aren't complementary to form-based code or vice versa. And you have to really think about that. Because VDOT is Columbia Pike is the state road, we have to coordinate everything with them. So everything we've done it as if they're going to agree with us, and of course they don't. Community expectations. Our people are so smart, they've questioned everything, including, you know, how do you implement a mezzanine correctly? What is it? How do you make sure? Oops. How do you make sure that the 60-foot rule is actually followed? What do you do about corners? With this increased scrutiny, there's been a group of citizens that have formed an advisory group that we have to work with. So as opposed to our original plan to check with citizens at the back end, we actually have to deal with them in the middle of the process. You know, everything that we're doing, we ship it off to them. We haven't done this yet, but we're going to ship it off to them and have them agree that everything is as it should be, and then we'll proceed. As a tool to help us, we actually come up with some stuff so that we can track and make sure that all the rules are being followed and create some accountability and some paperwork. We've amended the code a number of times. Only when our citizens said it was okay, not because we thought, you know, it was needed. So, you know, it's a work in progress. We're continuing to make these things happen. So we've got other projects that we're continuing to work on. Everyone is still upbeat about the code, especially our citizens. They're happy that, you know, the rules are in place. They embrace them. But certainly it's been a lot of homework on our part to get this stuff done. Thanks.
I think there may be a few questions for Richard and Farrell. Let's just take a few before we start the panel for general questions. Yeah, Jim?
Hi, I had a question for Richard. Do you have minimums as well as maximum building heights?
Yes.
And second question is, you said that applicants present their projects. Is that really true that applicants or developers are their architects, or are they the attorneys for the developers, as is the case in Montgomery County?
Yes, it's either the architect or the attorney.
Or the attorney. Okay, thanks.
Yes.
You said that the form-based code was an optional method of development along Columbia Pike. I don't see how you can have any conformity of height or anything if it's an option.
Well, in addition to creating the option, we actually have put in place some incentives to make it tasty and tantalizing to our
developers. But this is not supposed to be an incentive system.
No, they're in addition to. So what happens is if you develop under the form-based code, you may be eligible for county assistance on parking and things of that nature. Part of our form-based code is you have a lower parking requirement, you know, which is a key to development. One of the reasons why someone doesn't develop under the usual standards is that, you know, you could build it, but you can't park it. So what we do, as part of the form-based code, you can actually, we lowered the parking requirement.
Okay, but you're still not going to have conformity along your streetscape if some are doing it.
Actually, I'd put it differently, although I agree with everything Richard says. I would never recommend a code that is really optional, but functionally along Columbia Pike, with the exception of a couple, maybe three, of the the only large properties there, everybody else is the zoning and regulation form of gridlock. So, yes, you can go. You've got three options. You can go by your by-right zoning, which means you can't do anything because you're stuck. You're frozen. The one-story pizza delivery place on Columbia Pike can't build anything else because they're already below those requirements for parking, stormwater, etc. So, you know, the by-right zoning, for most 90% of the people, get you go back home, can't do anything. The site plan approval process, where you come out, and my version of that is it's like public mud wrestling. It's this big, messy public process where the developer, somebody wants 10 stories, they come in with 30, and then the citizens say one is too much, and it's a very unhealthy process and has poor results for everyone. If you do the form-based code and go by the rules, you may be mightily squeezed to six stories or four, however, but you've got certainty and quick approvals. So really, for most of Columbia Pike, it's not really an option. If you want to do something, the only way you're going to be able to do something is the form-based code. And your point about having some consistency, the whole idea it's a big master plan and every new building is another piece of the same puzzle infill, is possible when almost everyone is building towards the same puzzle. So you're right on that.
Let's take one or two more questions in this, and then we'll go back. Mark?
A couple of questions. One is the would you have to do a different form-based code for every community? In other words, if we were doing Montgomery County, would what was done in Bethesda be entirely different than what's done in Silver Spring, or is there an ability to apply these things more universally?
I want to jump in on that one. I think that the laying down of the lines on the map is definitely place specific. Some portion of the form standards can probably be brought over. So there are things to be learned from other versions of the code. It is possible that as you gain speed and experience with these, that you could do them, prepare them more swiftly, etc. We are right now experimenting on behalf of your neighbor, Prince George's County, with preparing a full toolkit. In other words, a set of form standards that we think will fit every supposedly urban mixed-use setting that they might ever want to build. And the notion would be then in the sector planning process, you would simply determine which pieces out of the toolkit you're pulling as opposed to actually drafting the toolkit every time. So yes, I think there are some things that could be pulled together that kind of give you the palette that you are painting with, but then each time you still have to paint by numbers.
This is Chinese menu zoning.
Are there places that use only the form-based codes and don't have the optional mud wrestling procedure?
Almost everybody has done it as a replacement for underlying zoning. The optional element, I think, has as much to do with Virginia law as anything. There's a huge fear of the potential of downzoning, et cetera, and so it was simply done optionally to be the easiest way to get it through in the time frame that they were operating with.
And my last question is related to transportation. No one's mentioned transit capacity or transportation capacity, as if the only part of design was simply the heights and setbacks of the building. And how do you deal with whether or not you have actually the infrastructure to handle? Do you determine, for example, if in looking at a 3-mile stretch of road, what's the maximum amount of traffic that can be handled there, and then apportion the density accordingly or something?
No.
Like that?
Actually, and I'd say that's the way we've been doing it in the past, and that's proved to be, our food couldn't get here on time because it was stuck in traffic. The cartoon way answer to that would be demand management. You solve the problem by building a world where you don't have to get in your car to do everything. I think the national average is 12 or 14 trips a day just to, get your milk, etc. An interesting statistic that Richard can tune me up if I'm off base, but when we were working on Columbia Pike in 2002, we were told that in the last 20 years, traffic on the pike hadn't changed. Statistically, it was the same, a few percentage points different. And if you think about Columbia Pike from 1980 to 2000, and think about all the stuff that got built in that area and out west in Fairfax, it's so against the rules of traffic and density projections that there's no way to explain it. It's like, from that perspective, it's just evil. But it's fact. The people found other ways to get through and to get places. So if you let the traffic capacity govern what you're going to build, you'll end up, it's kind of applying the logic of the wound, and the sprawl will just continue to roll out, and the traffic will actually get worse.
Let's take one on this side over here. Yeah, Sharon?
What I found interesting in the last discussion was that you have certain standards that are required for water management and road management and utility management that didn't seem to be brought into the citizen discussion, and then all of a sudden you found out that these were roadblocks into proceeding the way the citizens did. Is there any way to marry the required things of the structure, the infrastructure, to the design components?
No.
Yes.
All those things are, certainly they can be discussed. That we just had this discussion. We're trying to get a project approved on Columbia Pike, and staff had kind of worked through some of the technical issues with the fire marshal and all the other agencies, and based on that we came up with what we thought. It's a public project, it's a county owned site, and so we began a discussion with the community, understanding the limitations and so forth. and citizens challenge us on every point, as if they brought the fire marshal into the room, they could change his mind, you know. And somehow the, you know, the reality has to be, you know, has to set in that, you know, we can't, although there's a utopia out there.